I also like to thank Paul and Lucy for this very successful conference in the sense of the talks, and I really have enjoyed a lot of discussions with these colleagues, this type of conferences. Of course, this is the third day and the final lecture, so I expect that most of you are already as tired as me. So I am in a lucky situation. I have the hockey stick and I look forward for the evening. Probably Anaheim will. At least I hope for that. Okay, so my topic is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, and one reason for this talk could be that it is 80 years since the paper of Heisenberg where this principle was introduced. My main motivation, however, is not to celebrate this nice occasion. Indeed, there seems to be some new results which, to our understanding, brings some new information on this, and to some extent we probably feel that we now understand this uncertainty relations as kind of necessary and sufficient conditions for various types of things. So, in fact, my talk is based on a paper which we recently published by Paul and Dayton, and so I rely on that. And happy to have Paul here. If there are difficult questions, you can directly address them to him. But then, so I base on that, but there are some recent papers which indeed seem to bring quite much new light on this, and perhaps a kind of breaking papers that of Reinhard Werner, published in 2004 on uncertainty relations. He proved a very important theorem there which I want to refer, and on which much subsequent development has based. Then there is a series of papers by our younger colleagues, Claudio Carmeli, Teiko Heinonen, and Alessandro Toigo, two papers mentioned here, but actually there are three papers which is a nice set of results on the problem of joint measurements of position moment to offshore box. And then there is a more detailed work of Paul together with David Thurston on some kind of universal lower bounds for uncertainty relations. So this is, so to say, of course there's a huge literature on the subject matter, but these four papers together with our survey paper is the reason for this talk. So somehow, of course, uncertainty principle relations are extremely pretty well known to all of us, but often they are described as some kind of no-go statements, and I indicate here three possible formulations. Usually it is argued that it's impossible to prepare states in which position and momentum are simultaneously alternately well localized. Another version is to say that it's impossible to measure simultaneously position and momentum. And the third version, it's impossible to measure position without disturbing momentum and vice versa. Of course, these obviously are different things, but this type of ideas at least seem to go in the negative part. But indeed, one can say that the main idea of Heisenberg's paper was to show that in spite of this type of limitations, there are some possibilities. And in this sense, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle has also this positive aspect. And this means that typically one gives some kind of uncertainty relations in view of describing the possibilities, for instance, to prepare a system in states which, for instance, with respect to the standard deviations or approximate localization in phase space. On the other hand, this type of relations are often offered to express accuracies within which we can measure together these quantities. And finally, this type of relation is to describe the necessary amount of disturbance, for instance, in momentum caused by a position measurement, which is performed with a given accuracy. So again, quite different type of statements. And of course, the idea is to try to make clear what to formulate this and to show the validity of such results. In fact, in view of the previous talks in this conference, I added this small slide here. If we would take uncertainty principle to reflect any of these ideas, of course one could try to formulate them as a kind of epistemic axiom in any so-called generalized or axiomatic approach to quantum mechanics, speed, quantum logic, convex field approach, effect algebras, algebraic approach, and typically this would then rule out the classical case. So in this sense, one could say that they are non-classical features. Having been worked in so-called axiomatic constructions of quantum mechanics some 10, 15 years of my life, I have become very convinced that quantum mechanics is a Hilbert space quantum mechanics. So if I want to understand something in quantum mechanics, I really try to work with the Hilbert space quantum mechanics. Of course, this does not mean that that's the whole story, but presently I am very convinced with that. So, and when we are in the Hilbert space, of course, then this so-called principle is by no means an extra assumption. It is built in the theory, and what I hope to be showing that it really is a property of Hilbert space quantum mechanics, which follows in various formulations. Another thing probably is that, which might be worth to mention, is that with this positive aspect of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle probably could open similar possibilities than, for instance, this EPR correlations did. I mean, some good 20 years ago, these correlations were really seen as impossibilities for something, and only later it turned out that they can be used also. And of course now the whole quantum information is built on this type of ideas. So in the same sense, perhaps these positive aspects of the Heisenberg principle can in some states be applied. Okay. Yeah.
I have some reservations about where it is not an extra assumption.
Yes.
Because you can build a Hilbert space with a positional momentum operator which commutes. Mm-hmm. It's possible to build Hilbert spaces, okay? But the extra assumption in that case comes in irreducibility of the representation.
Okay.
So one way or other, you're putting in this assumption.
You called it quantum mechanics. Hmm? You called it quantum mechanics.
Yeah, quantum mechanics then means already
irreducible.
Yes. This is okay. Actually
yeah,
what
okay.
I...
Then it's okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. So I will study this problem really in compositional momentum observables, and since I do that, I can safely assume that I consider only spin zero object, and so I have the usual Hilbert space. Here I simply want to show my notion. So of course I have the usual position operator, its spectral measure, and then the usual probabilities for position measurement outcomes in a given vector state, and similarly for probabilities is this sprint. I think it would fit better. It's a funny thing, as soon as you saw the slide, then you recognize the misprint. Okay, but it's good. So in any case, operate with hat and then spectral measure and the probabilities, and of course F is a Fourier plastical operator. And the other things that I apply frequently is that given a probability, generic probability measure on the real life, then of course I have a standard deviation defined in the usual sense. And the other concept is the overall width, which is the kind of smallest interval length, what is needed in order to recover a probability at least 1 minus epsilon for given epsilon. So,
because this, you said yes. Standard deviation, would you then take delta p squared in that formula? You define the variance, integrals the variance.
Yeah. Indeed. That's the variance. So, with that I mean standard deviation, the square root. So, here I should be another miss. Thank you. Okay. That's nice. Okay, of course, this first case, preparation, restrictions on preparation is pretty well known. But just for completeness of the picture, perhaps I can quickly run through that. Of course, if we consider position momentum, they are continuous variables, so in a sense, it's not one can assign values for these quantities. But of course, if I take any spectral value of position, any point on the real line, and if I take any positive number epsilon, then I can always find a state such that the expectation of position in that state is the given number, and the standard deviation of variance is smaller than the given epsilon. And of course, then the well-known relation between position and momentum tells that if the standard deviation for the position is small, then necessarily for momentum it is big, and vice versa. And of course, this comes from the well-known uncertainty relations for standard deviation. There is a simple, perhaps pretty well-known, kind of positive aspect which turns out to be useful also later. Namely, if I take any two positive numbers which fulfill this relation, then I can construct vector states such that the standard deviation for position is that, and the standard deviation for momentum is that number. So a kind of sufficiency relation. This is certainly more than well known. There is another version of this, which refers to localizability. And here again, the starting point is that if I take any bounded interval, however small, there are always vectors so that the probability for that interval is 1. So in a sense, the particle is localized in that interval. And the relation between position and momentum then, of course, brings the well-known result that you cannot localize both position and momentum in any bounded interval. So if you take any bounded interval x and y, then if position is localized in that interval, then the probability for momentum is neither 0 nor 1, and vice versa. So the sum of the probabilities for position having value in a given interval, momentum having value in a given interval, is certainly always less than 2. But actually, one can solve that there's a stricter upper bound. It is 1 plus square root a north, where a north is the largest eigenvalue of this compact operator here. And what is interesting that this upper bound can be reached, there are vector states such that in that state, the sum of the probabilities for position and momentum taking values in the given bounded intervals reaches this upper bound. Here one can introduce already the notion of approximate localizability in the sense that if we consider a given interval, in a given state, we say that in that state position is approximately localized in that interval if the probability is at least 1 minus epsilon for some small epsilon. And then these previous results then give a kind of relation for the sizes of these intervals. If you consider both position and momentum approximately localized within some intervals with parameters epsilon 1 and epsilon 2, if they are small enough, then the sizes of these sets, the lengths of the sets, are limited from below by the number. And you can also write this in terms of the overall widths. These results are certainly more than well known and go essentially back to Landau, Pollack, and Lennart. long, long, long time ago. So this is pretty well. So the main new results certainly are only on this question of joint measurability and segments or measurements, position measurement disturbing the momentum and vice versa. And in order to discuss this question, it's really necessary, as we all know, but will become also evident, that we really have to use full power of Hilbert-Weiss quantum mechanics to consider observables as positive operator measures. And this way then will give us the appropriate notions of joint and sequential measurements and the appropriate quantifications of measurement inequalities. I will also need a bit of measurement theory, especially the notion of instrument as operation valid measure to describe the sequence of measurements. Of course, in the previous lecture we had sequence of measurements also discussed, but here we need them somewhat more general. These are pretty well known concepts, but actually I have a slide to remind at least myself what a positive operator measure is. So, of course, there are several equivalent definitions, and with Maura we yesterday discussed whether the book of Davis is an excellent book or probably not, and in my opinion, it is one of the most excellent books, and it's a nice introduction to all of these concepts. But in any case, so positive operator measures we know. Actually, here I consider only positive operator measures defined on the real line, products on the real line or R2. Of course, the notion is more general, but we don't need it. So let me consider only so-called real. So one way to say is that the set function taking values as bounded operators is a positive operator measure exactly when for all unit vectors this set function is a probability. And this is, of course, nice because it is expressed in the terms of the measurement outcome probabilities. And as already repeated several times in this conference, I also call the notion of SAR is represented by spectral measures, and otherwise unsolved. The lecture. Well, we had already the moment operators, and of course, if I take any positive operator defined on the real line, especially, I can define moment operators integrating the kth power of the identity function with respect to measure. Of course, in general, this operator measure, the support usually in our applications is the whole real line, so this means that one has to pay some attention on this type of objects. We have paid, but I don't want to bother you here. But in any case, for instance, there's the first moment operator and the second moment operator. And if you use them, of course, then the standard deviation of the probability measure defined by the observable and the unit vector can be given in terms of as the expectation of the second moment minus the expectation of the first moment square. Now I happen to have this square here. Of course, the crucial point is that operative measures need not be complicated, and this is a key thing. It's useful to have some characterizations of, let's say, degree of unsharpness of an observable. How much a semi-spectral measure, positive operator measure, deviates from spectral measure. Of course, we know that spectral measure is exactly the multiplicative one, but this is not an operational thing. So one thing that you can do is, and what is often also applied, that you introduce the so-called noise operator or intrinsic noise operator. If you subtract from the second moment, the square of the first moment, it turns out that this is always a positive operator. And if it turns out that the first moment operator is self-adjoint, which is not, it is a technical question, but it's not always okay. But if it is, then this noise is zero exactly when the operator is measured sharp. A result which has been well known for bounded operator measures, but has required some care for in general cases. Using that noise operator, of course, you can define the expectation of the noise operator, and we call it intrinsic noise in that state. And of course, you can then take the supremum of these numbers. So, yeah.
Why is an I there? What's the I?
I refers to intrinsic. And because we still see that there are also other types of noises involved. So, usually we call it only noise, but in this context, I think this additional characterization is appropriate. Not fine. Another possibility to try to single out spectral measures, or at least unsubstantiated, is the so-called resolution width at a given confidence level. Again, we fix a small epsilon. And let us define then a quantity which is, so to say, the smallest interval length which you need. So let us look at the notation. We have an interval around point x of length d. If you scan this interval over the whole spectrum, you always find, for given middle point of the interval, a vector state such that the probability is at least 1 minus epsilon. And of course, if this is a spectral measure, then you immediately recognize that this number is zero. If it is non-zero, then this is definitely unsubobservable. But there are unsubobservables which do have that resolution width equal to zero. Typical examples are, for instance, we have already today discussed several times canonical phase. It is one where all the non-trivial effects, I mean the operators in the range of the operator measure, do have norm 1 perfect. The norm is 1. And in that case, of course, that comes also 0. So in a sense, those highly non-commutative operator measures are close to spectral measures. I guess that your example might fall in the time of time also, at least for some even operator in that frame. The notion of instrument state transformation has been here often, so I can be very quick. I introduce it here from the point of view of measurement theory, which we know that at least completely positive instruments do have this type of representation. So, but I don't go into the details of measurement theory, but in any case, this would be the apparatus Hilbert space, the initial state of the apparatus, the point of so-called unitary evolution. Then you have this probability reproducibility formula to determine the observable action measure, but at the same time, it also determines how the state of the object system is changed, conditioned with respect to the measurement result. So this defines the state transformation operation on the set, operation that is measured on the set of states of the object system in the surrounding picture. And if you go to the dual Hausdorff picture, then we have the, so to say, the dual of these operations giving the dual instrument, and of course these effects can then be written in terms of this dual. And Stan had a special variant of this operator, he had the square. Of course, this is an operation, not an operator. Yes, okay, this is pretty fun. And of course, if I am given, measurement is given, meaning an instrument is given, then of course there's always a non-selective state change. The initial state of the object system gets transformed. So the initial state and the final state without reading the measurement result is then that. And of course, this then shows that the probabilities of any observable if given by a semi-spectral measure are changed in the course of this measurement. And this changes here. And you can read it also as a change of this observable. So the observable, an ordinary observable F in the Heisenberg picks gets transformed under that measurement through that formula. So in a sense, a measurement always, so to say, distorts any other observable. And of course, the question is how much F prime differs from F. Depends certainly on the applied measurement. These are usual, well-known concepts, as well as the following concept, joint measurement. So if we are given two observables, positive operator measurement on the real line, we say that they are jointly measurable if there is an observable on R2 such that E1 and E2 are the marginal observables. And of course, this concept of joint measurement is fully supported by the quantum theory of measurement. It is exactly the one which comes from the idea that you can construct the measurement which measures both of the observables in question. So E1 and E2 are coexistent, not even functional coexistent in this case. So then, of course, E1 and E2 are the marginal observables of M. So given an, this observable on R2, this formula, of course, always determines the marginal observables. And in that case, if E1 and E2 are jointly measurable via that measurement which produces our M, then of course E1 is N1, E2 is F2. But here is an, well, somehow pretty well known, but very important result to be observed. If one of the observables E1 or E2 is sub, meaning projection type, then in that case, if they are marginals of joint observable, or even if E1 and E2 are contained in the range of the same observable, then they necessarily commute. So if one is sub, then they necessarily commute. And in that case, there is only one possible joint observable, which is the product, which is a nice result. And of course, this immediately tells us the old, very well-known result that since position and momentum are sub observables and they do not commute, they cannot have a joint observable. So this is one way to put this pretty well-known result. So the only way to go around to is that we consider an observable on R2, which is, and we should call it an approximate joint measurement for position and momentum if the marginal observables M1 and M2 in some appropriate sense approximate Q and P. This seems to be the only possible. So this means that we should be able to quantify this measurement inaccuracy or approximations comparing M1 with Q and M2 with P. And in a sense, any appropriate quantification of this difference should do as a measure of approximation. The case of sequential measurements is turns out to be very similar. So in order to analyze the question how, for instance, position measurement disturbs the momentum, one has to describe the position measurement. So in general, we consider two observables, and if we consider the measurements in immediate succession, then we have to describe the first measurement. And to describe the first measurement means to give an instrument which is induced by the measurement. So let us assume that we first measure E1, apply a measurement scheme which defines an instrument I1, and then we measure E2. And if you consider the sequence of measurement, it always determines what is known to be kind of bi-observable, which uniquely determines a joint observable on R2. So there is a unique positive operator measure on R2, which has the property that it associates with the product sets, this operator E2y, and apply the operation E1x2. And if you consider this joint observable, which the sequence of measurement defined, then you see that the first marginal is the observable you measured first. And the second marginal is a distorted version of the second observable. So in this sense, there is to be expected, of course, that the chicken observable really gets changed. But here again we see that if the first of the observable E1, which we decide to measure first, if it is sharp, then the two marginals are mute. So in that case, the distorted effects which are associated with the second observable, they compute with all E1x. And again, we then immediately see here, if we consider position and momentum, if we perform a position measurement with, let's say, sharp position measurement with any instrument, then it necessarily distorts the momentum. But let us recall that position is, so to say, maximal quantity. It means that all these distorted effects, momentum effects, are functions of the position effect. In this sense, one can say that the position measurement maximally disturbs the momentum. There is no momentum information left after the position measurement. And this we take as one possible formalization of this well-known no-go theorem C. So these no-go theorems are given, and of course then, of course in this case of sequential measurements, so we obtain the sequence of observable. So one way to go ahead with the position momentum problem, first for instance measuring position and then looking at the disturbance of momentum, the only hope to get some momentum information is that the position measurement is inaccurate or unsound. So we have to replace the first position measurement with an appropriate approximation to position. And then there is could be the hope that the momentum, distorted momentum, would then be a reasonable approximation to the sharp momentum. But we see that from formal point of view, this sequential business is completely the same than the joint measurement business, because what we really need is a joint observable which in an appropriate sense approximates the position and momentum. So in this sense, if we are able to solve the first problem, the joint measurability problem, then immediately the same results apply to the sequence measurements as well. Of course, then what is needed is kind of quantification for this accuracy of error. We should be able to tell in which sense an observable approximates another observable. So, and of course, a typical situation in quantum measurement theory is that, for instance, if we intend to measure, for instance, a sharp observable, and if we use any realistic measurement scheme, typically we obtain an unsharp, a kind of smeared version of the observable we intended to measure. But in any case, if we formally we are interested in comparing two observables, E and E1, and the deviation of these two things should then quantification of the deviation of two observables should then count as an error of inaccuracy or disturbance. And of course, to express them, we like to follow the operational approach in the sense that this differences should be expressed in terms of probabilities, measurement of probabilities. Okay, this is very clear. And with the disturbance, it's exactly the same. I don't need to repeat, any measurement disturbs any other observable, and the question is to compare these two things, and we do it in terms of this probabilities. So I show you here three possible quantifications for these notions of accuracy, disturbance, or error. All of them have been used. The first one is what we call standard error or disturbance, which really has been used in some formulations of quantum theory measurement, namely And let us now consider the case that we are interested to measure the sharp of slope, which is position momentum. And we apply a measurement scheme, and the actual measure of slope is given by E. Then one possible way I denote this epsilon E A psi C, but the motivation comes from the measurement theory. Here we have the point observable and the observable that we wish to measure. We compare somehow the values and the difference of the values squared in that. If you spell that out, then you see that this quantity, which is defined in terms of the measurement scheme, as given here, then you have the expectation of this intrinsic noise, and then the expectation of the difference of the first moment of the measured observable and the observable we intended to measure squared. And here we call this other part relative noise. So now we have relative noise and intrinsic noise. Here one should immediately say that in all cases this seems not to be really operational, because E1 and A may well be non-commutative, mutually non-commutative operators, and in this sense, this formula, the relative noise cannot always be reconstructed from the measured statistics of E and from the statistics of A. But in many applications, actually, this also works nicely. But in any case, this has been used quite much in the literature. So we have these numbers, and of course, you can then, in which way they are, you can then take the supremum of these numbers, and we call it standard error. And we say that this is a standard, E is a standard approximation to A if this standard error is 5. It's one possible characterization. Another one, of course, was introduced by Reinhard Werner in his paper, which I already referred, and which is very important here. So let us consider a set of functions, real functions, which fulfill this Lipschitz condition. Then, of course, you can integrate any such function, and you always obtain bounded self as an operator. And then the distance, which the concept of distance applied by Werner, they, I call it Werner distance. Of course, it's
E is an inspection measure.
E, well, now E1 and E2 are any two positive operators on the real line, and given them, you can form all these operators, and you take the difference and expectation, and absolute value, and then you quantify all states and all possible functions. And of course, this is a measure of difference of the two. And it's also operational, because here only expectations are involved. Whether it is experimentally accessible is another question. But in any case, this has been used. And again, we say that E1 is a geometric approximation to E2 if the distance is 5. And of course, this is symmetric. And then the third, this really goes back to Paul, who will be used to stand up and explain. But let me try. Is the concept of error bars, which plays with this idea of approximate localization. So here we consider an observable E1 approximating a sharp observable E. So E is a spectral measure, E1 probably not. So we call E1 an epsilon approximation to E. If for all positive numbers delta, there is a positive number W, such that for all points, and for all points and for all unit vectors, if our sharp observable is localized in the delta interval around the point 1, then the other observable is localized in the W interval around the same point with the probability 1 minus epsilon. So it's this idea that we already saw. And then you take the infimum of such numbers, and then it is called the inaccuracy of E1 with respect to E. And it has a nice, well, here's an official definition. And using the properties of this, you can see that then it is an increasing function of this delta, so that we can define what is called the error bar of E1 relative to E as this type of point. And again, if this is finite, then we say that E1 approximates E in the sense of finite error. So here are three examples. Of course, you could possibly invent more, but three possible measures to characterize the difference between two optional models.
Which is symmetric, like if E1 approximates E, then also E approximates E1 with the same error?
Well, this is not because here we really need that, you know, this condition, we really need that this is a spectral measure. The sub optional.
Oh,
yes. Of course, probably the idea could be generalized, but then, of course, then you don't have this type of condition in general. Then, probably, if you would have this non one optional. But in any case, we are going to apply to position and momentum, then this is what is needed. Okay, so let us then see how the impossibility to measure position and momentum at the same time leads to a possibility. So we ask for a joint observable, let's say on the phase space with marginal observables M1 and M2, which we would like to approximate Q1P. There are several cases. Just for curiosity, let me mention the first result that, of course, position and momentum are non-commutative things, and actually they are even totally non-commutative operators. But in fact, they do have commuting spectral projections. If you consider spectral projections associated with the periodic sets, then you find if the periods of the sets are appropriate, and of course this then so that there are functions of position and momentum which are mutually commuting. And of course if you take any such functions f and g, they have been characterized by, here I refer to there was already earlier work by Paul and Frank Schreck, who was a third of that.
Schoenbeck.
And also Thiering had something, and probably we also. But in any case, you can characterize the commuting functions of position and momentum. That has been done. And of course, if you consider such coarse trainings of position and momentum as functions of Q and P, then certainly they are commuting so that they have the joint observer. And this is a nice thing. But if you compute this distances, then you'll find that in the sense of the approximations that we quoted, this is very bad. The standard error, as well as the geometric distance, as well as the error bars, are all infinite. So in this sense, these are very bad approximations, even though they are used, in, for instance, in solid state physics. They have beautiful applications, but from the point of view of joint measurements, they are really good. So this 20 years ago, we studied this type of thing. So this is not the whole story. The next class is pretty well known covariant position and momentum observables. It's well known already for a long time that these examples give formalize the sufficient part of the problem. But even there are some recent results which are mostly due to Karimeli, Heinonen and Toigo, and therefore it's good to recall these results here. So if you take the spectral measures spectral measures of position momentum. And if you take any probability measures, mu and nu, then you can use the convolutions. We have seen already these formulas, at least in Pavlov's lexile, I think. So any probability measure together with the spectral measure of Q defines a positive operator measure. And similarly for the moment. And this certainly have exactly the same symmetric properties than the sharp position and moment. And of course, if you actually now it is known that if you consider any translation covariant velocity boost invariant, also for on the real line, it is exactly of this form. If you consider any velocity boost covariant translation invariant of object, then it is necessary of this form. So we can say that. Okay, we can say that this sub that this covariant answer position and momentum observers are all of this type. But let us go a bit further. We have the while operators already used here, and we say that an observable N is covariant, phase space observable, it fulfills its natural covariance condition with respect to while representation. And as was already given by Paul, we know several characterizations for these objects, and any covariant phase space observable is generated by a unique positive trace one operator. So they all have that particular structure. And if you consider the marginal observers or this joint observable, then the marginal observables are exactly of this form now with special probability measures, obviously fully related to each other. So that's, and then indeed, okay, if we are given this positions, unsub position observable determined by probability measure mu, unsub momentum determined by probability measure mu, you can ask which of them are jointly measurable. And then indeed we have this beautiful result that among these covariant unsub or approximate position and momentum observers, exactly those are jointly measurable which are marginals of the phase measure. So this is one important. And here probably I can recall that in the very beginning I have this smallest trivial theorem which says that if I take any two positive numbers, delta q, delta p, such that the product is has a log bound, h bar divided by 2, then I can construct, I can give a unit vector so that the standard deviation of position operator is the given number and the standard deviation momentum. So this then shows the sufficiency of isoelectric relations for joint measurements. Namely, if we are given that the measurement inaccuracies, so to say, are given, for instance, with these numbers, then I can choose this t, positive trace one operator, to be the pure state given in the small little variable. Okay, but in that concrete case, one can more or less quickly compute all these possible errors which was given. And of course, the standard deviation is pretty well known. If you consider standard deviation of this first marginal, then it is the standard deviation, or let's say variance of the first marginal, it's the variance of the position, sub position, plus the variance of the probability measure. So there is always something coming in addition. So in a sense, this additional term is then a possible measure of inequality also. And the same for momentum. And of course, then there is this well-known relation between the standard deviations of this marginal observer. You can compute the noise operators in the intrinsic noise operators, and they are really simply the variances of these probability measures which are involved. Of course, there's a unit operator. So even for intrinsic noise, you obtain this in equality. one can compute the resolution which, and it turns out that the resolution which they do have a lower bound, which is given here. And one can compute the standard error, and again, there is an inequality for the standard errors. One can compute the distances, the Brennan distances in those cases. And here, the trade-off relation is interesting. One again obtains a lower bound. Of course, in all of these cases, the lower bound depends on the measure that will be applied. But here, it's interesting to recall that this lower bound actually can be reached, but it is not reached by the Gaussian scale. And this number, which is here, it can be numerically computed by the existence of the state. I think Wagner even gave a concrete construction of such a state, which gives a lower bound. But it is not Gaussian, but in any case, the lower bound can be reached. Error bars can be computed, and again, you obtain a trade-off relation. So you see that there's a lower bound which depends on how the aggregations. So in all these cases, measures, we have of course joint measurability, but also Heisenberg type inequalities to characterize the inequalities involved. Then the basic result here is. Of course, the next step is to show that the uncertainty relations in one of its formulations is also a necessary condition for joint measurability. It's certainly sufficient, but the question is it also necessary? So the question is that if you take any observable on the phase space, and if it has finite distances from sub marginal finite distances from the sub position and sub momentum, then one can construct actually covariant phase space observable generated by an operator T, which is a better approximation. So you see that the product of the distances of M1 from Q times M2 from P is at least the product of G1 T from some position and the second partner for momentum, and it has a lower bound. So here we see that uncertainty relations appear also as a necessary condition for joint measurability. And this result of Werner can then be worked out actually for all of this this inaccuracy measures, and the result is that if you consider any phase space observable, any joint observable, I mean observable defined on the plane, and if its marginal observables have finite approximations to Q and P in any of the senses I have been discussing, then in each case one obtains an inequality for the standard error, for the distance, and for the error bars. I think this is more or less. I don't go here into applications. Paul discussed already quite detailed in Dr. Kelly model. And let me only mention that also the sequence of position momentum measurements can be modeled in terms of covariant phase control. Okay, I think it's time for me to stop here. Thank you.
Questions? Could you go back to that transparency where you had the covariance condition? I just wanted to see what you said it again.
Yes.
Yeah. No, my question is the following. If you impose covariance,
yes,
does that tell you that your QOV measure has to be built up from a one-dimensional prediction operator?
No. No, here, in fact, any positive trace one operator will do.
Yeah, but, yeah. Okay, and irreducibility.
No.
still
reduce the unity of what?
This representation is.
Oh, you can take a convex combination of all of them.
Yes.
But okay, then my question would be. But that's a trespass operator. T is a trespass operator.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah, it is trespass.
It's trespass. Yeah. Okay. So there will be an extreme point for one of those.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
But yeah, so you can. So in other words, these are sort of the atomic ones in some sense. The ones which come from one
dimensional projections.
In one dimensional.
Yes.
Okay. If that is the case, then I have a suggestion for a whole. What should I say? This is. You can start a whole new field over here in the following sense. You know, people who do signal processing, okay? I mean, in signal processing, there's wavelet analysis and there's what they call time frequency analysis.
Yes.
Time frequency analysis is exactly this, okay?
Yes.
And what they do is basically look at purely measures like this. This is not the language that they use, but this is what they do. And then they sample it at certain points so that the resulting you get a discrete theory measure, okay? And you want a frame so that you know it's a bounded operator, a bounded inverse, something like that. Okay?
Yes.
And then they study error bars on these things. So I think a lot of the results that you have on errors and all of these things can be used in a very powerful way to derive many of the results that those guys get.
Thank you for the invitation. The work is not finished. Yes.
No, it means you need a couple of fresh graduates.
Yes.
There's
a question here. I have several questions. First question is, you obtain final several Heisenberg type inequality. What is the condition for your measurement G, joint measure? You need
for
variableness?
For the joint measurement.
Yes, yes.
In fact, from the beginning, it is any observable on phase space, if I can use this.
Any medium, any POV?
On R2, yes. From the outset, it could be any positive operator, POV on R2. And then we can ask whether its marginal observables are approximations to Q and P in some appropriate sense.
Appropriate sense?
Well, I have shown three different possibilities to compare this marginal measures with the sharp positional momentum.
I want to discuss this later, but I have another comment.
Yes.
In this slide, you assume that the covariant condition.
Yes.
Yes, and if you assume covariant conditions, the P of M described by this unique distance.
Yes.
I think this fact already pointed by Polyakov, and he analyzed such a deviation error comes from T, and how to realize this P of M also mentioned.
Well, I didn't want to offer this characterization as a new result here. It's well known. As Paul indicated, there's a whole history of proofs for this. And I think that today we are rather sure that it is a correct expression. There are independent proofs applying group theory and Radon-Nikodym theorem for operating measures. And so we always end up with the same result, so we are more or less believing in this. So this was not, so to say, the new result.
No.
Yes, it's, so to say, well known.
Yes. And in your presentation, you don't assume what we call unbiasedness condition. Unbiasedness condition is this average operator equal to the required
meter. Yes.
But
you don't
consider.
Well, there's no need. I mean, of course, some of these certainly fit.
But if you assume this condition.
Well, of course, if I consider this covariant phase of
then you obtain covariant unbiasedness condition.
Well, it depends on these measures.
Sorry.
I mean, if the expectations of this probability measures are zero, then the measurement is unbiased in that sense that the first moment is the sharp.
Okay. If you assume unbiased condition,
I don't assume.
You don't assume?
Yes.
You don't assume?
Yes.
Never
yes.
assume?
Yes.
Why?
I don't assume.
Why?
Why should we assume that the measurement is unbiased? It is one possibility, but this covers all.
Okay.
Yes.
For example, if you assume
such a condition, I could assume. That's true.
There is several simple results.
Of course, yes. It would simplify in some of the formulas here. Of course, if it is unbiased, then this is the second moment of the probability measure, because the first moment would be zero. That would be the unbiased case here also. Certainly, there are such, but we don't need to assume it.
You don't assume. This is a difference from existing result. Okay? This point is different from
Well, let us say that the unbiased case is included here. We don't need to say anything special on that.
Okay, okay.
Yes.
This point is different from existing result. Okay?
Okay.
More general,
yes.
Whatever result it means, yes. There are certain relations of the same form for the unbiased case.
Sorry, yes.
Without unbiased, without, you obtain the same inequality without unbiased condition.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
So are there any other questions?
Just a thought. Can I go back to the rules like this?
Go back in which sense?
Coherence.
Yeah, yes.
So, you know, like if the unit positive operator of trace one, which means, you know, it's a convex combination of one dimensional.
Sure, yes.
If you can trace that by some kind of an integral over one dimensional projection operator, presumably you could still get coherence, couldn't you? You know, like it's like a sum again. So why would that not be?
As long as that easier trace class, it's not
positive. It would still be trace class. It would still be.
So, well, you can have either a discrete sum of fundamental projection, or you can have a cylindrical sum.
That would still be trace class. Yeah.
Yes. Well, you can do that. Yeah. You take a continuous probability.
No, what I was saying is, if it is not possible to hook up an operator which is not trace class by resonance, maybe not.
Yes. Can you say? I think we can, but of course, can put here also more general operators, but you
don't know. And maybe something like that.
That's true, yeah.
So it just integrates. Mm. It just means that you stay with every class. That's it.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to produce a counter example.
Yes. I mean, we would very much come on that, because it would destroy a quite big part of it. Yes, yes. It would be very prudent. We could start anew.
Are there any more questions? And if not, let's thank you.